Good morning.
Good morning.
And I'm glad to be back at Beth Tikva. And I thank Rabbi Grover for making this possible, as well as Beth Tikva for the fact that we were able to do this series without charging. That's due to the generosity of the synagogue. Our series is a three-parter. Histories leading Philosemites, Philosemites, you can pronounce it as you choose. This is a reaction for me, because I did a series of classes, 4 weeks, on histories leading anti-Semites. And as much fun as that was, it occurred to me that we really should also be talking about the ones whose actions helped us. And one of the points that I want to look at is the question of why certain historical figures helped us. What the agenda was. Was it simply love of Jews? Was it self-interest? Was it divine manipulation? We have to figure out what's going on. When there have been people who have indeed benefited us, I want to look at their motivations, I want to look at their impact down till today. Some of the impacts are really remarkable, far-reaching, and unexpected. I'll give you one, just as a spoiler for next week. We're going to talk about King Casimir. He is a king in Poland in the 13th century, and believe it or not, historians understand that his actions back then, which were very helpful to Jews, influenced the whole fight between Netanyahu and Poland that's been going on for the last year about blame for the Holocaust. It makes a lot of sense. Once you read the story, once you understand what Casimir did and how it impacted the way that Poles viewed themselves and their relations with Jews, you start to understand much more what's been going on in recent times about blame for the Holocaust. So there are all sorts of very interesting topics that come up within this. The lessons we're going to learn include more than just history, because it's also very much about Judaism, how Jews have interpreted events to understand how Jews and non-Jews interact, God's role in human events. There's so much more to talk about. So some of you were here for the, not here, it was at Beth Emeth, but the final week of the anti-Semite series, and I talked about a topic then that I want to explore in a little bit more detail now. And that is something called the lachrymose theory of Jewish history. I know there are sheets around, but I don't know where they are.
They're on the seat.
They're on the seat. Oh, okay. So anybody who's coming in now who needs a sheet, look at chairs. That would be my advice. There actually are some on the chairs in the front, come to think of it. Shocking that anyone would have expected someone to sit there. But it's been known to happen. Just barely. So for anyone who was not at the class where I talked about the lachrymose theory of Jewish history, what is lachrymose?
Jews.
Right, tears, tear-filled, correct. So I brought you a quote from 1928, an article by Salo Baron, one of the premier historians of Jewish history, in which he wrote, in number one on the sheet, "Surely it is time to break with the lachrymose theory of pre-revolutionary woe and to adopt a view more in accord with historic truth." In other words, there's a theory that says that before the Jews were emancipated in Europe, and this is a very Ashkenazi-centric view, right? It completely ignores the reality of Sephardic Jewry. Everything is about the Ashkenazim. But the idea that until the emancipation in Europe, Jewish life was misery. We suffered, we reeled from one disaster to another disaster. And Baron clearly doesn't like that theory. And when you look at the past 2,900 years or so of Jewish history, give or take, going back to the heights of King Solomon, where you look at the last 1,950 years since the destruction of the Second Temple, would you describe those years as good years or bad years? I hear up and down, I hear mix.
Location, 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 right? Where...
Well, let me ask the question this way. Let me ask the question this way. Let's take the last couple of thousand years, okay? Starting after the year 68 or the year 70 when the Second Temple is destroyed, and running up until, I don't know, 2019, what would you describe as key moments in Jewish history? I don't mean scholarship, but key moments in Jewish history. What would you identify?
The Crusades.
Crusades, Inquisition. Sorry? Holocaust. Pogroms.
Expulsion from Spain.
Establishment of the State of Israel.
Expulsion from Spain.
You hear the balance here between the types of events. I'm not hearing an awful lot of these, you know, wonderful moments. 1948, establishment of the State of Israel. I heard one. And I heard, you know,
7-11 when the Arabs made their way up.
Yeah, let's talk about Sephardic Jewry a little bit. Let's talk about the conquest. The golden age of Spain that may or may not have been golden. Right, as we discussed a little bit in a previous series, the idea of the convivencia as a period when things are good between Jews, Muslims, and Christians really depends on whose vantage point you're coming from. The Muslims did very well in that period. The Baron's argument is that we had good times as well, and they were, as was noted, in particular places. Right, the idea of location being significant is certainly accurate. You know, as we're going to discuss today, Cyrus the Great supports our return from exile to build the Second Temple. The Poles take us in during the Crusades, and we'll talk about that with King Casimir when we talk about the history of the Jews in Poland. The Ottomans take us in at the end of the 15th century. We did very well in the Ottoman Empire when we were expelled from Iberia. The Poles again took us in the 16th century when hatred from Germany forced Jews to flee. Even in times of difficulty, we have had places we could go in order to, in fact, not just survive, but thrive. And more, we thrived in some very difficult situations. If you take a look at source number 2, this is fascinating from Baron's article. He says, it is certainly significant that despite minor attacks, periodic pogroms, and organized campaigns of conversion, we'll just pretend those didn't happen. No, he says, despite those things, the numbers of Jewry during the last centuries preceding emancipation, meaning running up to the 18th century, the end of the 18th century, increased much more rapidly than the Gentile population. Now here you see his asterisk, jump to the bottom of the source. Pre-revolutionary population figures given here are by no means certain. I arrived at them after a careful study of all available source material. It is impossible, of course, to give these sources here, or to explain the methods of textual criticism and synthesis used in arriving at the conclusions. It has long been apparent, however, that figures given by our classic histories are far from reasonably exact, which is all that mine pretend to be. As I parse that last sentence, I think what he means is that he pretends to be far from reasonably exact. I'm not really sure. But he's acknowledging the difficulty of coming up with real numbers, real population numbers, in a period when you don't have a sophisticated census by any stretch of the imagination. But now going back to the earlier part of the quote in number 2, after the asterisk, having said that the estimates will be inexact, the Jewish population in the middle of the 17th century probably did not exceed 650,000 out of more than 100 million inhabitants in Europe. In 1900, okay, so now you've jumped ahead, the Jewish population of Europe exceeded 8.5 million, while the general population was about 400 million. So in other words, general population went up fourfold, and Jews went up more than tenfold. That is, the Jewish rate of increase from 1650 down to the beginning of the 20th century, when the mass of Jewry was still unemancipated, was three times the rate of Gentile increase. Furthermore, in the same period, European Jewry built the Great American Center, right? Because that includes the end of the 19th century, when Jews, many Jews in significant numbers, go to the New World. So Baron's point is that even aside from the places where things were good, even where things were bad, we actually managed to thrive. And if you measure based on population numbers, recognize that not everyone is working based on population numbers as their measure of thriving. That's understandable. But more than that, the persecutions themselves often made us stronger. We're going to talk about that more in the last week of this when we talk about Napoleon and whether Jews actually were better off post-emancipation. But take a look at source number 3, where Baron makes an interesting point about economics. What of the economic situation of the Jew? Despite all the restrictions placed on his activities, it is no exaggeration to say that the average Jewish income much surpassed the average Christian income in pre-revolutionary times. This is hard to prove, and certainly excessive wealth was rare, except among high nobles and clergy. But is it not remarkable that the most typical ghetto in the world, in Frankfurt, produced in the pre-emancipation period the greatest banking house of history, which was, of course, Rothschild? And before Rothschild's day, such central European Hofjuden as the Oppenheimers and Wertheimers and such West European bankers as the Pintos, Madonos, and others were not far behind rich Christians in their financial power. Paradoxical as it may seem, the very restrictive legislation proved in the long run highly beneficial to Jewish economic development. It forced them into the money trade, and throughout the Middle Ages trained them in individual enterprise without guild backing, compelled them to set up wide international contacts, and equipped them with vast sums of ready cash. With the dawn of early capitalism and the need for ready money for the new manufacturers and international trading ventures, the Jew fitted readily into the new economic structure. Yes?
It was proven later that this was actually not good, because all the anti-Semitism, the Jews have all the money, they own all the banks.
Well, so that's the question, right? That's the question. Without a doubt, we faced great hatred because of the financial success that came in this, in this area of activity, and it continues down till today. Don't kid yourself. At the same time, you have to ask yourself: is it better for us to be broke and sympathetic to the general population, or for us to have the means to build communities and institutions and thrive, and they don't like us, even as it will lead, without a doubt, not just to them not liking us, but to violence against us? This is a real question. I would go back to Egypt with this, right? Go back to the beginning of the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus, where we are told, Kasher Yanu Oto, Kein Yerbevechein Yefrotz. As the Egyptians oppressed us, so we spread. So we increased in number. Well, that resulted in slavery, right? Then it didn't work out well for a couple of hundred years until we ultimately got out. But you have to ask yourself, so do I want to spread and thrive and grow and deal with hatred and oppression? Or do I want to be the suffering nation that everybody likes? Yes?
Even if we had stayed poor, they would still
hate us. Well, that's a separate point, right? Origins of anti-Semitism were complicated. This is true. They didn't actually need the money trade to cause them to hate us. But Judaism tends to agree with Sello Baron, meaning the Torah's predictions of exile foretell great suffering, destruction, and the church tried to tell us that God had abandoned us. I brought you a quote in source number 4, Robert Chazan from European Jewry in the First Crusade. He's quoting what the church said to the Jews of the time. Indeed, your God was never pleased with you. While he sought to do well by you, you did evil before him. Therefore, he has forgotten you and no longer desires you, for you have been stiff-necked with him. He has separated himself from you and has shown favor to us and has taken us as his portion. That was the Christian line. But Jewish tradition has insisted that God never abandons us and, in fact, ensures that we will survive. That exile has a purpose. It's not just about random destruction. If you take a look at source number 5, I brought you 2 sample verses where God says to the Jews, even then, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not have rejected them. I will not have found them disgusting to destroy them, to nullify my covenant with them, for I am Hashem, their God. Another verse from Deuteronomy, it will be when many ills and troubles befall him being the Jewish people, and this song, which is a reference to the Torah, shall be a witness before him, again, the nation, for it shall not be forgotten from his descendants, .. Exile is understood as not random destruction, but a process. And so, Moses Nachmanides made a very interesting observation. He was a believer in the idea that is called in Hebrew, Maaseh Avot Siman Labanim, which means the deeds of the ancestors are a sign for their descendants. So he looked at the story of Jacob's fight in the middle of the night with some mysterious being, right? Remember the story. Jacob has to flee the house. Esav, his brother, wants to kill him. He's away in the house of Laban. He comes back. He's got four wives. He's got a whole bunch of kids. He comes back into the land of Israel, and right before he's going to meet up with his brother, he gets into a fight in the middle of the night with some mysterious being who succeeds in wounding his thigh. But Jacob is ultimately victorious, or at least fights him to a stalemate. So Nachmanides, Ramban, in source number 6, says there's a message in the wound to Jacob's thigh. And the message is that the enemies of the Jews are going to fight Jacob's descendants. And they are going to succeed in wounding the descendants. The image of the thigh, the source of those descendants. However, they're never going to be able to destroy all of us. They're not going to be able to kill us. Jacob ultimately survives this battle that he has in the middle of the night. So that's one point, is that the exile is supposed to have a safeguard, that we're not going to be destroyed. More than that, classically, Judaism looked at the suffering that we experienced and saw in it ways in which God is working to help us survive. Behind the scenes, often. Best example, the book of Esther. Right? In which we are not told about what's going on behind the scenes, but we understand the divine hand is making things work. Rabbeinu Nissim, in source number 7 in 14th century Spain, made the point as well. He argued that the fights between nations that cause them not to ally with each other helps Jews, because it means that when one nation is against us, the other nation is going to take us in. So the fact that the Christians and the Muslims were fighting was actually good, because when the Christians expelled us, the Muslims would take us in. That was the way that the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, and again, he's 14th century Spain, he's living this. That's the way that he explained it. So that, number one, this is a good time to remind people about phones. I should have done it at the beginning. I apologize, I forgot. But number one, exile has a purpose. It's not random destruction, and there's a plan for our survival. Number two, God is willing to manipulate the world in order to enable that survival. And number three, most fascinating to me, in source number 8, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, writing in Spain in the 11th century, makes the argument that the Jewish experience in exile is like that of a seed in the ground. The seed, as he writes there, I'm not reading it out loud just because I want to get to Cyrus, but you see it there. The seed deteriorates and breaks down in the ground, and then the result is, well, in my yard, a weed. But the result is supposed to be a beautiful plant, a flower, a tree that's going to bear fruit. That's what we're looking to have emerge from the exile. It's a period in which we are broken down in the ground, but in order to grow and prosper. Now, not everyone agrees with Salo Baron, meaning his point that you can have an optimistic view of Jewish history is subject to dispute. There are those who agree, and yes, there are those who disagree. But my last point on this is what I brought you from him in 1963. You could have made the argument that he wrote his initial article on the topic in 1928. He didn't see the Holocaust. You know, would he have the same rosy view of Jewish history had he seen the Holocaust? Well, take a look at what he writes in 1963. He holds his ground. All my life I have been struggling against the hitherto dominant lachrymose conception of Jewish history, because I have felt that an overemphasis on Jewish suffering distorted the whole picture of the Jewish historic evolution. At the same time, it badly served a generation which had become impatient with the nightmare of endless persecutions and massacres. In other words, if you tell your children that Jewish history is miserable, that to be a Jew means to suffer, to be tossed around all of the different countries, to be impoverished, to be tortured, to be murdered, and so on, yeah, their answer is going to be, so why am I signing up for this? Right? Show me the exit. I'm not interested in that. So in perpetuating what he believes is a myth, we hurt ourselves. And I think that's a really important point. So what we're going to do here, and where we're going to go from this, is to look at, as I said, three cases within Jewish history in which there are figures who did things that clearly have a goal of benefiting us. And we're going to ask, what motivated them to do it? What moved them to do this? Was there another agenda? Was it something that they just liked the Jews? Do we see a hand of God involved? How do we look at it? How did Jews look at it back in their day? And what is their impact today? So that's an awful lot to get through. We'll get as much as we can. So let's talk Cyrus. So historical background for Cyrus the Great. This may be familiar for those who are at the series I did a couple of years ago on the Persian kings. So this may be somewhat familiar, but since it was a couple of years ago, I don't remember what I said. Maybe you do. So when you talk about the Assyrians, you have to talk a little bit about the Persians, I should say. When you talk about the Persian, can you hear me if I stand this far back from the mic? You're still okay? Okay, because I feel like I'm doing something to it. When you talk about the Persians, you have to go back to empires first, and back to the Assyrians. Basically, the way the greater Middle East looks at that point, if you can picture the Mediterranean and Israel on the eastern shores of the Mediterranean, right? So you have one anchor in the south-southwest, and that is Egypt, right? They're not going anywhere. That's Egypt over there. And then off to the east/northeast, you have a series of empires that rise and fall over time, inevitably trying at some point to conquer Egypt, because that's just the big sport at that point. So I gave you a little bit of a timeline in sources 10 and 11 to try to help. The Assyrians are the major invader during the middle of the First Temple period. Standard historians will put them at somewhere around the late 8th century before the Common Era. Jewish tradition has a little bit of a different number, but it doesn't affect us for what we're going to talk about today. But Assyria invades west. They conquer all of the nations in the region, including major conquests in Egypt as well as Ethiopia. They also are the ones who exile the 10 northern tribes. When you talk about the 10 lost tribes, the Assyrians are the ones who exile them. They conquer Judea, and that goes back and forth a little bit. They conquer Judea, Judea rebels, and ultimately they reassert control, and Assyria is the power there for a good chunk of time until the Babylonians rise. And the Babylonians ally themselves. They're also rising off to the east. They ally themselves with some smaller nations as well. And they defeat the Assyrians. They also come through Israel. They also conquer Israel. There's a series of back and forths where they appoint puppet governments, kings who would be loyal to the Babylonians. We keep on rebelling because, you know, we can't take a hint. And ultimately they come in and they destroy the temple. So the Babylonians are the ones who destroy the first temple, exile the Jews, and then they in turn are conquered by a new empire that arises in the east, and this is the Persian Empire. The year when the Persians defeat the Babylonians is the year 539 before the Common Era, and they are led by Cyrus II, also known as Cyrus the Great. There is some dispute, I referenced it in source number 11, between the account found in Jewish sources and the secular ones about the role of other nations like the Medes in this. Were they allies of the Persians? Were they equal of the Persians? But it doesn't matter for our purposes. What does matter for our purposes is that in the year 539 before the Common Era, the Persians crushed the Babylonians. Cyrus the Great is now king of a very large empire. Tanakh, our scripture, records the following in source number 12 about something Cyrus did in the first year of his reign over this great empire. Take a look. In the first year of King Cyrus of Persia, when the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah was fulfilled, I'm going to come back to that, the Lord roused the spirit of King Cyrus of Persia to issue a proclamation throughout his realm by word of mouth and in writing. So this is the first year, not the first year that he was king, but the first year of this expanded empire where he conquered the Babylonians. when the word of Jeremiah was fulfilled. Anyone know what the word of Jeremiah means here? What word of Jeremiah was fulfilled? Nope. No, this is when Cyrus defeats the Babylonians. Jeremiah had predicted that 70 years after the rise of Babylon, they would be destroyed. That they would have 70 years of power. How you measure the 70 years exactly, how you count it, is an interesting debate. But Cyrus, at this point, issues a proclamation, word of mouth, and in writing. Thus said King Cyrus of Persia, "The Lord God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and has charged me with building him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Any one of you, of all his people, may his God be with him, let him go up to Jerusalem that is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord God of Israel, the God that is in Jerusalem. And all who stay behind, wherever he may be living, let the people of his place assist him with silver, gold, goods, and livestock, besides the freewill offering to the house of God that is in Jerusalem." That's a very interesting statement. On a whole host of levels, right? Look back at the beginning of his words. The Lord God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth. Which God is he referring to? Right? It sounds like ours. It sounds like our God. You think he means his own? We'll have to see. No, we'll have to see, because it's not. You could make the argument that he's referring to his, but we'll see more about this later. He says, "This God, the Lord God of heaven," which in the Hebrew uses the names we associate with our God. I should point out, it's not the names of a Persian god. He isn't talking about about Zoroastrianism. He isn't using their terminology. He says, "This God charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judea." That certainly sounds like ours. They don't build a Persian temple in Jerusalem. We know the temple that they build in Jerusalem is in fact going to be ours. So it doesn't sound like he's referring to their God. It sounds like he is referring to our God. And not only that, but anyone who is staying behind should help. Should assist with silver, with gold, with goods, with livestock, send offerings. Why in the world would the nation support the Jewish return? What is that about?
Stabilization of empire.
Stabilization of empire, how? What does that mean?
Well, I would think he's got a huge army, right?
Yes.
But they're not cultivating anything, so he's going to need produce of the fertile crescent.
But there were people living there. There were populations there, meaning when the Jews go back to that land, they run into trouble with the residents who are living there. Remember that the Assyrian method of conquest was population transfer, so that after they defeated the local population, they'd move that population out and bring in other populations they had conquered. So that we find, biblically, the names of various populations who end up being moved into this land that we had occupied beforehand. And it's not as though we come back to find an empty space. There are real issues there. He didn't need us to come back and be the farmers. Sorry, there was someone else had another answer. So you're going to say Cyrus makes this decree because Jeremiah's prediction came true about the fall of Babylon within 70 years. We do find that the nations around us in the region are aware of prophecies of ours. We find that in our text, and we find it actually in contemporary texts of theirs. So it's not beyond the pale to think that. But do you think that your average Persian citizen feels like therefore they want to send us money to support our return to Israel? Yes.
I'm just thinking he may want to have people who are supportive of him and the land, and he'll be getting taxes from them at some point.
Right, so we definitely have to talk about Cyrus's motivation more. But I'm asking first, before we get to his benefit, your random Persian, why in the world are they going to support our return to Israel? Maybe they don't like us as neighbors.
Yes. Cyrus returned all the captive peoples, other than our people, to their the places that they had been removed from by the Babylonians to centralize them in their kingdom. And by having them in their kingdom, they could be a threat to them, a threat from the inside. So he dispersed just not our people, many other captive people to back to their...
Almost. But again, you're talking Cyrus's goal, not the goal of your average Persian.
By Ezra. So these are Ezra's words. What makes us think that he's talking to the non-Jews that are living in Persia? Maybe he's identifying the Jews that are staying behind wherever they may be living.
Right.
Those are the ones who have to donate the silver, gold, goods, and whatever.
Right. And the answer is because it's not Ezra's words. This is Ezra's book that records the Persian decree. This is actually Cyrus's decree. We get more of the decree if you flip the page onto source number 12. It shows up later in the book. When they go hunting for Cyrus's decree, they find more. In the first year of King Cyrus, King Cyrus issued an order concerning the house of God in Jerusalem, that the house be rebuilt, a place for offering sacrifices, with a base built up high. Let it be 60 cubits high, 60 cubits wide, with a course of unused timber for each three courses of hewn stone. So in other words, stone, 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 wood. Stone, 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 wood. The Talmud looks at that and says yes, because he wants an insurance policy. If we ever rebel, he can set fire to the wood. The expenses shall be paid by the palace, and the gold and silver vessels of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian, had taken away from the temple in Jerusalem and transported to Babylon, shall be returned. Let each go back to the temple in Jerusalem where it belongs. You shall deposit it in the house of God. It's a really friendly decree. Not only that, take a look now at number 14. Because it's not just a decree, but in the Jewish record, so it happens. So the chiefs of the clans of Judah and Benjamin, primarily them, because they were the dominant population that remained after the 10 tribes were exiled, but it's not only them, and the priests and the Levites, all whose spirit had been roused by God, got ready to go up to build the house of the Lord that is in Jerusalem. All their neighbors supported them with silver vessels, gold, goods, livestock, precious objects, besides what had been given as a free will offering. So now we find out that actually there is assistance for them to return. Keep reading. King Cyrus of Persia released the vessels of the Lord's house, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken away from Jerusalem and had put in the house of his God. These King Cyrus of Persia released through the offices of Mitridates, the treasurer, who gave an inventory of them to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. And here's the inventory. 30 gold basins, 1,000 silver basins, 29 knives, 30 gold bowls, 410 silver double bowls, 1,000 other vessels, in all 5,400 gold and silver vessels. Sheshbazzar brought all these back when the exiles came back from Babylon to Jerusalem. Okay. Interesting side note. What's missing from the list of the vessels that were returned? The ark? The menorah? Right? The Talmud recognizes here that there were certain vessels that never made it back. And that leads to a lot of debate. So where are they? Are they in Ethiopia? Are they in Babylon? Were they buried under the Temple Mount? Were they in a Hollywood movie? What exactly happened with all of these missing vessels? It all comes from the fact that we have a list of what's sent back. And the list is nice. I mean, I'm not going to say no to 5,400 gold and silver vessels. But I'd like to know where the ark is. You know, the bowls. What am I going to do with bowls? It's just an example of bad registering. So this is the story as it's accounted in Jewish sources. This is the story that's given to us. Yeah?
Was this before or after Esther?
So that actually is a dynamite question. Dynamite question in the sense that it blows everything up. The question that was asked is, was this before or after Esther? Here is the problem in brief. Ahasuerus of the Esther story is a Persian king. Therefore, he has to be after Cyrus. You don't have an option of putting him before Cyrus, because it's only with Cyrus that the Persians grow and conquer and spread to create this empire of 127 lands that are described in the book of Esther. So therefore, Esther has to be after Cyrus. This poses a couple of problems. Problem number one is, if Esther is after Cyrus, then why are Esther and Mordechai and all these leaders living in Persia? Why didn't they go back to Jerusalem? Number two, why is there no reference in the book of Esther to a temple in Jerusalem? You talk about all the Jews gathering and fasting and praying to God. Why not mention anything about a temple in Jerusalem? There are more challenges that actually come up with this, but those are the two basic historical ones. Yes?
Yeah, there's one right there where we're told, you know, take all the vessels and dishes and everything. But in our tradition with Esther, one of the reasons we were threatened was because the king used the dishes, all the dishes, golden vessels, and his.
Good. Right. So that's another of the sources that creates a problem with this. I wasn't going to go into it because it's not a historical concern. It's now rabbinic tradition issue, which is that the Talmud talks about an odd verse in the book of Esther in which it describes how Achashverosh at his big grand party used kelim mikelim shonim, which literally means different kinds of vessels. It looks like he had mismatched sets. And that doesn't really fit the image of this grand party that he makes. So the Talmud has a variety of explanations for what that line means. The sages in Midrashic sources have different explanations, but a dominant approach is that they were vessels of the temple, which is extremely problematic because those had already been shipped home. So there are ways to resolve that Talmudic passage, but in terms of the overall problem, the answer seems to be that this story of Esther occurs during a period within the Persian kings when we were not allowed to build. Because we started building, and then the Samaritans got wind of our construction. The Samaritans were populations who the Assyrians had moved into the area, who didn't like us. And they said, hey, let's build along with you. And there's some dispute as to what their goal was. Either their goal was to make the temple into some kind of joint facility that they could use to worship their gods and we would use to worship our gods, or alternatively they wanted to sabotage it. They're going to join the construction in order to undermine it. But either way, the Jewish response to them is no way. It's not for you to build this temple with us. And the result is, they say, fine, then no one gets a temple. And they go back to the Persians and they say, don't you know the history of these Jews? Once they build up their defenses, they're going to stop paying you taxes. That's their response. And at that point, they succeed in halting the construction, because the Persians do a little reading and find out that's actually probably true. That's more or less what we do. There's some dispute as to when that took place, because the Persian letter back to the Samaritans' letter to the Persians talked about building a wall at Jerusalem, which they weren't building at that stage. But the bottom line out of all of it is that there's a period of years where we are not able to continue the construction that Cyrus had licensed, not until King Darius allows us to restart it. And within that, there's a view in the Midrash that Darius is actually the son of Esther, and that's why he allows it to restart. So that's the long answer to a short but important question. But let's get to the key question here for us, which is, how do you mind read a Philo-Semite? Meaning, he encourages us to build, right, to return to our land and build the temple. He didn't need to do that. He offers us support from tax dollars, as well as tries to get people throughout the Persian Empire to support us in our return. What in the world is his motivation? So one answer you could give has already been mentioned, and that is it was strategic. Right? He felt it would work for his empire. I want to come back to that idea. I'm not quite ready for it yet. The first and simplest answer is one that historians gave for a very long time, which is, it never happened. The Jews made it up. Why in the world are you reading their Bible to learn history? The answer for a very long time was, this was a Jewish fairy tale concocted to make us feel good. That, oh yes, the Persian emperor, the one who conquered the Babylonians, recognized the God of Israel and said, I'm going to help you Jews build a temple in Jerusalem. The real historical story was that we just sort of migrated back after the Persians beat the Babylonians. Maybe even we started out in Babylon, had never been there, and so on and so forth. All the different things that people might want to say in order to make Jews call this story into question. And that was actually a fairly standard view. By the way, I forgot to note it, but in number 15 I gave you a link. That's to an audio recording of a class I've taught that talks about the return of the temple vessels more and its significance, some of the chronology issues. So if you were to go there, you'd be able to hear more about it. But the first view has been the whole story is fabricated. Many took that as the story until a key archaeological discovery in 1879, which I'm going to come back to. I'm not ready for it yet, but it confirmed elements of the story. So since 1879, they've come to accept that Cyrus permitted our return to the land, endorsed construction of our temple, even if they disagree with parts of the record of the announcement that appear in the book of Ezra. There's a fascinating intellectual discussion of this and of the points of the debate in an essay which I quoted a little bit of in number 16, The Edict of Cyrus in Ezra 1. Very catchy name. He should have tried, you know, leading Philo-Semites of Jewish history. That's a much better title. But he says, since there was a return from the captivity under Cyrus, which he acknowledges, the king must have issued a proclamation summoning the exiles to go back to Jerusalem. But it is another question whether the text of the proclamation is trustworthy as given by the chronicler or has been more or less altered from its original form by the hagiographer. In other words, he's willing to acknowledge Cyrus sent us home. He's not willing to acknowledge the text that's found in Ezra. Okay. That's one position. However, second position is a religious position that goes to the exact opposite. And it says that actually Cyrus was manipulated by God into sending us home. Because we have a prophecy that goes back before the time of Cyrus that promises that Cyrus is actually going to do this. If you take a look at source number 17, source number 17 is one of Jeremiah's predictions of the 70 years of exile in Babylon. I'm going to skip it just because that's exactly what it is. It's the prediction of the 70 years of exile. You can read it there. It's not directly Cyrus related. But then take a look at source number 18 from the book of Isaiah. This is part of a broad theme within the book of Isaiah in which Isaiah talks about the way that God is able to predict the future and manipulate future events as distinct from the way the idols work. The idols can't tell you what's going to happen in the future. So take a look at number 18. Thus said the Lord your Redeemer, Isaiah says, who formed you in the womb. It is I, the Lord who made everything, who alone stretched out the heavens and unaided spread out the earth, who annul the omens of diviners and make fools of the augurs, who turn sages back and make nonsense of their knowledge, but confirm the word of my servant and fulfill the prediction of my messengers. You follow that so far? Okay? I mean, the English is archaic. Understood. It's not bad as translations go, but I pulled it out of the JPS. The only thing I did was take out the V's and the thou's. But what he's saying is, this is the introduction, I am God who make the counsel of these sages, diviners, and so on foolish. I am the one who confirms the word of my prophets. And he continues now, we're on the fourth line. It is I who say of Jerusalem, it shall be inhabited. And of the towns of Judah, they shall be rebuilt, and I will restore their ruined places. I who said to the deep, be dry, I will dry up your floods. I am the same who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd. He shall fulfill all my purposes. He shall say of Jerusalem, she shall be rebuilt, and to the temple you shall be founded again. Now, this prediction, if you take Isaiah as having been written when it's supposed to have been written, which is to say, middle of the First Temple period, not middle, towards the end of the First Temple period, 100 years to go or so, is made long before Jews have met any Persians. Not only that, at this point, we only distantly know about the Babylonians. So what still has to happen after this prediction is the Babylonians come in and destroy the temple. The Persians destroy the Babylonians. And then Cyrus sends us back. There is no Cyrus at this point. Cyrus's grandfather probably hasn't been born at this stage in history. But here in the book of Isaiah, you have the naming of Cyrus. Now, obviously, people who don't believe in prophecy have a very hard time with this idea. And this is one of the pieces of evidence that are used to make the argument that there are two or even three books of Isaiah, and they are sandwiched together by Jewish sages to make one book of Isaiah, but that this occurs later on in history. I'm not particularly interested in the debate right now about how many books Isaiah has. I believe it's one book, and I think that the evidence supports it. The issue here, though, for us is that there is a prediction that Jews have as a tradition that Cyrus is the one God will pick to bring the Jews back. And it continues. Thus said the Lord to Cyrus, his anointed one. He calls him Mashiach, right? Mishicho is the term in the Hebrew. Whose right hand he, God, has grasped, treading down nations before him, ungirdling the loins of kings, opening doors before him, letting no gate stay shut. I will march before you and level the hills that loom up. I will shatter doors of bronze and cut down iron bars. I will give you treasures concealed in the dark and secret hoards so that you may know that it is I, the Lord, the God of Israel, who call you by name. God is saying to Cyrus, I am the one who has chosen you. I gave you a link in number 19 to a class I taught that introduces Isaiah that talks more about the question of whether there's one book of Isaiah or multiple books of Isaiah. But the point for us is that within this view, right, we had one view that says that Cyrus didn't let us go, and if Cyrus did let us go, it wasn't with a statement about the God of Israel. That's one take. Opposite extreme is to say, look at that. God predicted it. He called the shot. Before there ever was a Persian set foot on the land of Israel, or for that matter in Babylon, he already said the Persians are going to defeat the Babylonians. There's going to be a Persian king named Cyrus. He is going to act on behalf of God, and he is going to send the Jews to return home. And the answer then is, God has manipulated Cyrus such that it's the first year he defeated Babylon, and he immediately sends us home. How does Cyrus know about this prophecy? Some student of Isaiah. Somebody communicated to him this prophecy that the Jews had. If you go back to the beginning of the book of Ezra that we saw in number 12, tell me, what do you see in Cyrus's decree that supports this point of view? I'm sorry?
When the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah was fulfilled.
Well, that's Ezra talking. Within the decree itself. He says, the Lord God of heaven has given me all this kingdom. Right? He is the one who gave me everything. It's his own statement. It's Cyrus himself saying that. Not to mention, in the previous line, the Lord roused the spirit of King Cyrus of Persia. In other words, it is God who is driving us. So your first view is there's no such thing as, you know, some foreign king embracing the God of Israel. Then you have your opposite view that says actually the God of Israel embraced him. And if somebody helps the Jews, it must be because God is directing traffic. And then you have the third view, which I think is the correct view, which is there is an element of mutual benefit that is involved. And you will... No, before I get to what I... Sorry, I jumped ahead of myself. First, let's take a look at the third view. If you take a look at the picture on your sheet, the Cyrus cylinder. So, the Cyrus cylinder is a small clay cylinder, less than 1 foot long, discovered in 1879 in Babylonian ruins. The writing on it is Akkadian cuneiform. And this is legit. The contents of the Cyrus cylinder declare that he is restoring Babylon and supporting the temples of Marduk. Who was Marduk? Well, in our, we may use it as Mordecai. I like it. It's a nice name. But who was the original Marduk, so to speak, in this story? The Babylonian god. I mean, the Babylonians had multiple gods. But he is a Babylonian god. And the contents of the Cyrus cylinder declare that the god of the Babylonians has embraced Cyrus, elevated him in his conquest of Babylon, and assigned him the task of rebuilding the temples to Marduk in Babylon. In other words, the same thing that you find in Ezra regarding the Jews, just change the names. Instead of it being Marduk, it's the god of the Jews. Instead of it being the temples of Marduk, it's our temple in Jerusalem. But it's the same message. Why? Mutual benefit. Take a look at source number 20. Professor Lucas Schulte. Good public relations. What Persian propaganda tells us about the Nehemiah memoir. Inscriptions ranging from the first Persian king Cyrus through Artaxerxes in the book of Nehemiah reveal elements in common in both Babylonian and Egyptian texts. The Cyrus cylinder describes a Babylonian god Marduk choosing Cyrus to rule kindly over the Babylonians as, quote, king of Babylon. This inscription demonstrates important Persian propaganda innovation. They use the language, in that case it's Babylonian cuneiform, the inscription style, because cylinders like this have been used for centuries. He invokes local gods, Marduk and Nabu, and the local royal title, King of Babylon, of their subject people, speaks their language. No previous kings in the ancient Near East had used this combination of methods. Chapters 40 to 55 of the book of Isaiah depict a similar image of Cyrus in a Judean religious context. God gives Cyrus authority over Judah and the nations, and Cyrus is even given the royal title of Messiah. In other words, Cyrus himself is making a smart political decision. And it is a smart political decision. Because if you do the conquests the way that people did them before the Assyrians, okay, so go back in terms of the history of conquests. You conquered a population, you subjugated them to your rule, and then what happened? They rebelled. That's what happens. It's the story of how many empires, right? It's only a question of how long can you keep them down and how much can you get out of them before you lose. That's the way it worked in history. The Assyrians thought they had refined it. If we transfer the populations, it's harder for them to be able to rebel. And that makes sense. But the Persians have a much better method. Don't give them reason to rebel. You conquer them, and then you free them. As long as they pay you, we're good. I'm fine with that. And in fact, that's what Cyrus does with the Temple of the Jews. One of his rules that he creates for this temple, I should have brought it on the sheet, but I didn't, is that when you learn the book of Ezra, you find that he exempts those who work in the temple from Persian taxes. What has he accomplished? Besides, obviously, making the priests like him. What else has he accomplished? He's made it a Persian government building. The temple in Jerusalem is now, you know, the Scotiabank Center, so to speak. It's the Persian temple in Jerusalem. It's the King Cyrus temple in Jerusalem, is what he's accomplished. It's now a Persian government building. Those who work there are working for the Persian government. Therefore, they're exempt from having to pay the taxes. Tax money, local tax dollars, are going to go to support the offerings and sacrifices that are being brought in the temple. He has co-opted it. And that way, all the Jews who are happy to have semi-autonomy in their land and who are happy to have a temple, they will be forever reminded that they're actually Persian subjects. And yes, that you pay your taxes to the Persians. Why not? I'm perfectly comfortable doing that. It's a very smart strategy. That's what Cyrus thinks he's doing. So, how does Tanakh really perceive this? How does Jewish tradition perceive what Cyrus does among these three views? Clearly, Jewish tradition did not accept the first idea, the idea that we made it up. But Jewish tradition has accepted the second and the third view. Meaning, the view that he's being manipulated by God is very clear in Isaiah. Right? He is God's anointed one, God has summoned him to do this, and so forth. But also the view that he doesn't think he's doing this in a religious way. He thinks he's doing it as a strategy. Evidence? Source number 21, Isaiah said it. For the sake of my servant Jacob, Israel, my chosen one, I call you, Cyrus, by name. I hail you by title, though you have not known me. Cyrus doesn't know from God. Cyrus is not a prophet. Cyrus isn't a believer in Judaism. Cyrus thinks he's playing out a political strategy. God says, this is the end that I wanted, and I am going to enable it to happen. This is an idea which we find described in Jewish sources as something called Ruach HaKodesh. Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration. Not prophecy. Maimonides says it's the lowest level of the prophetic experience. I brought you two sources about this in 22 and 23. 22 is Maimonides' description of how Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, works. And what he says is, often what God will do is energize somebody to perform some deed that by nature they would have done anyway, but they need help. They need courage sometimes. They need to be a little more bold. They need the energy to carry it through. And so God will take who the person is already and simply amplify it. That's this Ruach HaKodesh, this divine inspiration. And if you look at my last source, Rabbi Shimshon Rafal Hirsch says, that's what this is. When we read the verse that said, God awakened the spirit of Cyrus, regarding the king of Assyria, Kings 2, 19:7 says, I will place a spirit in him, and he will return to his land. That was the Assyrians. When we're talking about the Assyrian attack on Jerusalem and then their retreat. Regarding Cyrus, God awakened the spirit of Cyrus to allow Israel to ascend to Jerusalem. In all of these verses, the spirit is not the intellectual foundation. God doesn't tell Cyrus, here's a good strategy for you to do. Do this, do that, whatever. That's not the way it works. But the force moving the will to a deed that is ethically good or bad. God is pushing Cyrus. So what we get out of this, what emerges overall, is the following. First of all, go back to what we discussed in the first 15 to 20 minutes. As Salobaro notes, there are times when things are good for us. Judaism tends to teach, as we saw in the sources at the end of that, that this is part of a divine plan, that God is manipulating things in order to help us to survive. Rabbeinu Nissim was one example, the idea that we're like the seed being put into the ground and then ultimately we will emerge as a weed. This is the idea that Jewish tradition tends to bring to such situations. And in one iteration of it, Cyrus helps us by enabling us to return to Israel. But Jewish tradition has not assumed that Cyrus liked us or that Cyrus was a believer in God. Rather, the assumption is that, like with other kings, if you go back to the biblical Pharaoh as the best example, God manipulates him. He thinks he's serving his own self-interest, and God is moving him to help us. That's the way that Cyrus has classically been viewed within Jewish tradition. What we now are going to need to see next week will be King Casimir in Poland in the 13th century and what he did and how Jews perceived it then, as well as, again, the impact that that has in our own day. And then in the third week, we'll look at Napoleon and the great debate that raged in the Jewish world of the time. Is Napoleon an agent of God? And we should embrace him because he wants to emancipate the Jews? Or is Napoleon actually the enemy of God and of the Jewish people? And we'll see how that debate played out. I've got a minute and 20 seconds. Stephen.
Is it not conceivable that Cyrus had heard of what happened to the Egyptians under Pharaoh?
It's always conceivable that he had heard of it. But he doesn't invoke it. He doesn't mention it.
Doesn't mention it, but if he had heard of it through legend or fact, he would have had fear that this one people that they now conquered, not the others that they conquered, had a powerful...
But he did the same thing for the Babylonians, right? He built up the Babylonian temple in the name of their god. So it doesn't really sound like it's a Jewish-specific thing. He thinks he's got a political strategy. That's the way I would read it. Yes?
how did the Cyrus say in there where you talked that they, it was Marduk,
yeah,
the god of the Babylonian? So where is Ruach HaKodesh?
Right.
If that's right, why did we need the Marduk? Why is Marduk?
Right, because this is not what he does for us. This is what he did for the Babylonians. Meaning, we don't have a Cyrus Cylinder about him sending the Jews back. What we have is a Cyrus Cylinder of him sending the Babylonians, well, the Babylonians haven't left, but building their temples and using language which parallels the language we find for the Jews. The assumption is that somewhere, not going to be in Babylon, it's going to be back in Judea, you will have an equivalent cylinder somewhere that someone, you know, one day is going to discover that has a text with us and with the names of our God instead of the name of Marduk and so on. But within this idea that God is guiding him, that God is moving him to this, he's given him a strategy which he's going to employ in all of these different ways without believing in any of the gods that he's actually invoking. Yeah, that's the way that I would see it. All right, thank you very much. I wish you a Chag Sameach, a wonderful Shavuot, and I look forward to seeing you next Wednesday, God willing.